Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. This week, I'm at the annual Institute for Functional Medicine conference, learning about the microbiome in all of its delicious complexity. So today, we'll have a pre-recorded program featuring a lot of unanswered email. This email from Patty, who says she's from the USA. Okay, Patty. Dear Dr. Dawn, I keep reading articles and hear other podcasts talk about AMSR. Autonomous sensory meridian response, being helpful to people with insomnia and stress. The problem is that no one really explains how or why it is helpful, and if it is really helpful for these problems. I've searched around, and the most scientific stuff I could find about it was at a website called ASMR University. Seems to be run by a doctor, but I know you can give the best overview of this thing called ASMR. Well, Patty, I'll do my best. ASMR is a neologism, meaning that it's a newly coined word that shows up about 2008. The actual term itself came out of the internet, and it's not a medical or clinical term, and that's why you weren't able to find much about it. So let's define ASMR first of all. It's typically defined as a pleasant tingling sensation in the head and scalp that can be triggered by sounds like whispering, brushing, visual stimuli, perhaps like a painting or a drawing. And this kind of took fire along about 2008, and a Yahoo group was formed, basically dedicated to other people who experienced this response. And built up about 3,000 members. There's been some back and forth in Wikipedia, whether or not this was scientific enough to deserve a Wikipedia posting has been the subject of the debate. But I guess democracy has ruled, and so there is, in fact, a Wikipedia post, which I think gives a pretty decent description of this as a euphoric sensation that's associated with paying attention to something pleasant. Now, the sensation's typically described as tingling, maybe pleasant buzzing sensation in the head and neck. Not necessarily the goosebumps feeling of whole body sensation that I think all of us are familiar with, that is related to the autonomic nervous system. So as far as claims around insomnia, there's nothing in the research to back those up, but there's really no reason to assume that it might not be true. I guess if your issue is insomnia, I'd recommend a few other things first. Next, we have an email from James in Hornell, New York. Pain relief, it's titled. My primary care physician referred me to a rheumatologist in November 2014. I was diagnosed with connective tissue disorder, vitamin D deficiency, and low white blood cell count. I've been taking vitamin D. The doctor started me on 50,000 unit pills taken once a week for 8 weeks, and then 2,000 units once a day after that. I also take 1 81-milligram aspirin once a day and 200 milligrams of hydroxychloroquine twice a day. How long should it be before I feel any relief from pain, stiffness, and fatigue? Thanks for your help. Well, taking your final question there, James, by now, if you have been using the hydroxychloroquine for 8 weeks and you have not experienced any relief, then you need to go back to that rheumatologist and try a different drug because you're not responding to it.
A more interesting question, in my opinion, would be exactly what have you got? And since learning about the connection between autoimmune disease and vitamin D, I've made it a point to check vitamin D levels in anyone presenting with what sounds like an autoimmune disease at presentation or a history of an autoimmune disease. And it's been very surprising to me how much vitamin D deficiency I have found, sometimes levels down in the teens, which is really quite low. The epidemiology really comes out of the work of multiple sclerosis and strongly supports that vitamin D is protective against the development of that particular autoimmune disease. Now, I don't recommend the use of 50,000 units of vitamin D once a week because this does not correspond to physiology. There is a pharmaceutical pill, vitamin D2, 50,000 units, and that's why doctors use it. They're trying to help you out by giving you something that your insurance plan will pay for. But the problem is that this is a completely non-physiologic way of delivering a, well, it's not a vitamin, actually. Vitamin D is a hormone. And one of the things we know in endocrinology, and if you ask the endocrinologist about this with respect to estrogen or testosterone, they'd very much agree with it, is that when you give a massive dose of a hormone, you actually turn off the action of that hormone. In fact, you get the opposite effect because you sort of stun the receptors into non-action. Now, this is a big problem with vitamin D, and in fact, some studies have come out recently suggesting that giving 50,000 units of vitamin D, bolus vitamin D as it's called, may actually injure people. And this came out in a very big study. Vitamin D is bad for your health. But then when you went and read the methods section, when one goes to read the methods section, one finds that they were doing something completely non-physiologic. So here's what I would recommend. 4,000 units of vitamin D for maintenance because you got there somehow. But your doctor should be monitoring levels. There have been some excellent studies, I'm proud to say, studies primarily done by family practice doctors, looking at how much vitamin D do you have to give and for how long to bring up low levels. And in fact, there is an algorithm for this that's published, but a seat-of-the-pants rule, just for general consumption, is that if you use 5,000 to 6,000 units daily for 3 or 4 months, you'll probably take the levels from, say, a low of 20 to a nice medium level of 50 to 60. I shoot for a level of 70 to 80 in patients who have autoimmune disease, and I monitor blood levels and choose the dose that seems to maintain them in that range. For the general individual, the extremely conservative Institute for Medicine has said that up to 4,000 units daily has no evidence anywhere entirely in the medical research to show that any harm could accrue. Now, autoimmune disease is frequently driven by bacteria in the intestines. It's a kind of, well, mistaken identity. A bacterium might trigger the immune system to attack a protein or a protein sugar molecule that just happens to resemble your tissue. Furthermore, when your gut is full of good bacteria that modulate your immune system properly, it tends to downregulate the very aspects of the immune system that tend towards autoimmunity. So I think it would be important to perhaps study your gut flora, and there are a number of excellent alternative labs that will give you an analysis. And if you were to look at functionalmedicine.org, the Institute for Functional Medicine's website, you can find a practitioner who would know how to order and what to do with those results. Sometimes the bacteria in the sinuses or the prostate can also trigger autoimmune problems by being pro-inflammatory. But in general, you want to start with the gut in functional medicine. Another thing about the data that you gave me in your letter is the low white blood count. A low or borderline low white blood cell count in the absence of hemolysis, which can be checked by looking at a serum haptoglobin, that's haptoglobin, or getting a Coombs test, COOMBS, will suggest that a person might have food sensitivities. And food sensitivities create an immune complex between IgG and antigens from food that depletes the immune system indirectly of white blood cells through an immunogenic trigger. I hope you found this helpful, and please write me after you've explored some of these ideas. Janice writes in from LA with a complicated medical issue. I'm a 66-year-old Caucasian female. I have sarcoidosis, evidenced by oral and lung biopsies, Cushing's syndrome, and was just diagnosed with fibromyalgia. I'm on 10 milligrams of methotrexate a week, which seems to be keeping the sarcoidosis under control. I've had one adrenal gland removed, and my endocrinologist is trying to figure out why I still have high cortisol. When my cortisol spikes, it causes a central serous retinopathy in one eye, and I have some permanent vision loss from the many recurrences of this. My rheumatologist wants me to start on gabapentine for the fibromyalgia. Autoimmune diseases are rampant in my family. Both of my children have type 1 diabetes. My mother, sister, and daughter have all been treated for overactive thyroid. My son also has severe psoriasis, and my daughter, urticarial vasculitis. My mother, on the other hand, is 98 and healthy, other than for a very bad back. I live in LA and have Kaiser coverage, but I have some additional insurance that should cover second opinions. Do you think a naturopathic doctor would do anything different than what's being done? If so, is there anyone you would recommend in the LA area? I love your podcasts. Thanks for a wonderful program. Well, Janice, based on your pedigree, the first thing I want to say is that you have such a strong family history of autoimmune disease that my usual comments about making sure that you have good gut flora and high levels of vitamin D are really important, because these are the two leverage points that I'm aware of that work fairly consistently to modulate and blunt the effects of an autoimmune system. Not sure whether it would help in you, because it sounds like there's probably some sort of genetic mutation that sets you up for this. The other thing is that the fibromyalgia that you're describing doesn't follow from being an autoimmune disease. And I'm curious about exactly how that diagnosis was made, since it's something of a diagnosis of exclusion. So hopefully you've had a thorough rheumatological workup. I do think that a naturopathic doctor could help you get your gut flora in order, and I would encourage you to go to the functionalmedicine.org website and find someone in your area. Ideally, you're looking for a certified practitioner who's gone through advanced training in functional medicine. I've done that training, and I can tell you it's sufficiently arduous that you know the immune system and the endocrine system well when you come out the other end of those modules. Now, a couple of thoughts about Cushing's syndrome. First of all, for the audience, Cushing's syndrome is where people have high levels of steroid hormones in their system, and they develop a whole lot of side effects from that, including diabetes, osteoporosis, unusual fat deposits on the face and the back of the neck, and the torso, with thinning of the arms and legs, stretch marks, which are pigmented, a whole host of unusual symptoms, all driven by the myriad actions of cortisol in the bloodstream and the body. Most cases of Cushing's syndrome are caused by doctors giving prednisone for one reason or another, and often it's a good reason, and this syndrome is part of the price you pay for the therapy. However, a couple of thoughts. Since you've already had your adrenal gland removed and therefore cut in half the amount of cortisol that you should be able to produce, it is surprising that you still have the syndrome. Also, you mentioned that your cortisol level spikes, and that makes me wonder whether or not you could have a very rare brain tumor, not the usual one of the pituitary that excretes ACTH, which is easy to measure in the bloodstream, but a rarer one of the hypothalamus, which doesn't usually get tumors, but the hypothalamus controls the pituitary, and it makes a hormone called cortisol-releasing hormone. And this CRH hormone does not get into the bloodstream. It actually goes through a private little venous pathway called a portal system into the pituitary. So this could have been missed, and a tumor of this sort might episodically surge cortisol levels. So that's something that you want to go back to the endocrinologist and maybe ask for really high resolution MRI of the hypothalamus, because they may just have looked at your pituitary. Another thing that might be a factor, especially if you're still taking hormone replacement therapy, is that medroxyprogesterone, which is Provera, can rarely cause Cushing syndrome in susceptible individuals because it mimics cortisol for people who have a cortisol receptor in a certain shape. If you're going on and off Provera because you're cycling hormone therapy, that could be the X factor here. And of course, you didn't mention whether you were using HRT. In any event, I do think you could benefit by seeing a functional medicine doctor. They may not get to the bottom of what is going on with your Cushing's syndrome, but I think that they can help with the fibromyalgia. CO in Santa Cruz writes, Regland and side effects. Dear Dr. Motika, I was listening to your show in January 24th, 2015, and you read an email that someone sent about having GERD. One of the therapies I believe you mentioned was to consider taking Regland. My mother took a very low dose of Regland for a number of years and ultimately got Parkinson's from taking it. Parkinson's or symptoms of Parkinson's is a documented side effect of Regland. It's truly an unfortunate, unintended outcome of taking Regland. I just thought you would mention it. Thank you for a wonderful show. Well, CO, that is true. Parkinson's disease and more commonly tardive dyskinesia, a movement disorder involving sudden jerky movements of the neck and face, and occasionally the arms, are associated with long-term use of Regland. And in general, when we say long-term, we're talking about years. If I recall the email in question, and the advice that I generally give to patients is to use Regland short-term to get control of the symptoms, and then to continue with just hydrochloric acid with meals and demulcents or other protective agents at bedtime, and possibly, in extreme cases, the use of an H2 blocker to prevent symptoms. In general, I do not recommend long-term Reglan, and I consider long-term to be defined as greater than 4 weeks, but I do use it short-term in many patients, usually younger ones, who have intractable GERD, or in patients who have gotten hooked on proton pump inhibitors and then developed a complication and really should stop their PPI, if at all possible. Hope that clears it up. Our next email is from Sam in San Mateo. Subject, arsenic in rice. Hi, Dr. Don. I hope you received at your office and got to read Dr. Thomas Levy's America's Number One Killer. Would love to have your comments on vitamin C, lysine, and heart disease. Consumer Reports' recent issue commented on the high arsenic content in rice coming from certain states in the U.S., as well as certain countries overseas, with brown rice having the most arsenic. My concern is as we try to avoid gluten, we switch to consuming a lot of rice-derived products, which can have a rather high arsenic content. We don't know which location the rice is coming from, nor is an organization checking the arsenic content on these rice-containing products. Well, Sam, thank you for dropping the book off, and I did review it. I think that coronary artery disease is a bit more multifactorial than a single source, such as deficiencies of vitamin C. I do think that there are nutritional factors. I think amino acids are very important. But in general, when someone holds up a light bulb and says, this is the answer, they need to prove it with data. And I don't think that there's enough data there to make that the sole factor that we need to be looking at. Now, with respect to arsenic, we've covered that before in the archives, but briefly, groundwater has arsenic in it, and it concentrates in the plant, and so the grains will have levels of arsenic, which can be problematic, particularly in children who are more sensitive to heavy metals in general. I would say especially in autistic children who have difficulty getting rid of heavy metals, that daily rice cereal or use of rice every day is probably ill-advised, and maybe moving to other grains and varying the diet, particularly important in autistic children, but a good idea in children in general, because their guts are less mature and they do have a tendency to develop food sensitivities or even full-on food allergies with a monotonous diet of high levels of a single food. I have, in fact, had patients bump their arsenic levels when they switched to a diet that was high in rice or daily rice. So, unfortunately, this is a potential problem. But I want to emphasize that the amounts that we're talking about are very small. And unless an individual also has a high body burden of other heavy metals, such as lead or mercury, the impact on their health of these levels of arsenic is probably negligible. Mary in Cincinnati writes with a complex question. And before I read it, I want to emphasize that when you take supplements directed at your adrenal glands, you can get into trouble. You need to watch the dosing. Well, here's Mary's letter. I have a question. Back in October, I had a severe contact dermatitis-like reaction, rash on the face, neck, and hands with oozing and severe itching. My primary care doctor prescribed 20 milligrams of prednisone for 5 days and then 10 milligrams for 5 days. When I had just the last 20 milligrams left, I went to a dermatologist who said that it looked like a chrysanthemum reaction and gave me 120 milligrams of prednisone as Kenalog intramuscularly. The next day, I saw an allergist who prescribed another round of prednisone beginning with 40 milligrams for a week and then gradually tapering by three-day increments. 200 pills. So that was a very, very gradual taper. A few days later, after beginning the second round of oral prednisone, another rash, very different from the original rash, appeared on the backs of my thighs. This rash was more like a drug reaction. I also had side effects from the steroids, blood pressure increase, anxiety, highs and lows, almost a psychosis, disorientation, and bruising. After 2 weeks of trying to continue the prednisone, my PCP and dermatologist said to taper as soon as possible and get off the steroids. The original rash was gone, but the secondary rash remained until 4 weeks ago, and I suspect, if it was from the prednisone was now gone from my system. About 3 months later, I started to take 7-ketodHEA. I had not taken it for about 4 months. My alternative med doc has me take DHEA in the form of the 7-ketodHEA 3 months on and 1 month off with blood monitoring. I was going to start my 3 month round. I normally take 50 milligrams daily. I was only able to get 100 milligram tabs, so I split them and took half a pill for 3 days, and then I developed that same rash, not as severe, on the backs of my legs. Could it be from the DHEA? Is it a derivative of prednisone? Could it make the prednisone manifest again? I'm obviously concerned, as I've never had issues with DHEA before. I stopped it because I am now thinking I'm either allergic to DHEA and prednisone, or it's somehow made the prednisone allergy come out again. Tomorrow, I have allergy patch testing scheduled. Will any of this matter or alter the accuracy of the allergy testing? Well, Mary, probably your allergy testing will not be accurate. Here's what I am thinking is the most likely explanation for that rash on the back of your thighs. I think it may be a petechial rash or a capillary fragility rash. This is one of the side effects of prednisone, and you got a wonking dose of prednisone, no question about it, from that dermatologist and then the allergist. And you developed side effects from that, not Cushingoid side effects, but acute side effects related to prednisone toxicity, the psychological effects, for example. Now, after you tapered the prednisone, it was not advisable to take 7-keto DHEA. Let me explain. DHEA is a precursor to the steroid sex hormones and the adrenal steroid hormones, aldosterone and cortisol. DHEA, I should say, is the precursor for all of these hormones. And many people believe that the 7-keto form of DHEA is less likely to convert into the sex steroid hormones. So it's not as if you're taking testosterone or estrogen. And many people have concerns about taking these, and so that's why the 7-keto DHEA form is used. Your doctor is actually giving you a fairly high dose at 50 milligrams a day. That's a dose that is more typically given to men. It's on the high end. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily an overdose, but coming in with that dose on the heels of having had so much prednisone, I do think that you simply triggered the capillary fragility again. 7-keto DHEA does raise cortisol levels. So I think your threshold for that rash is lower than it was before, probably because the capillary fragility takes many, many months to resolve. I don't think this is an allergy to prednisone or DHEA. That is possible. But cortisol, which is a natural body hormone, and DHEA, which is also a natural body hormone, are things that it is very, very difficult, if not impossible, for the immune system to mount a reaction against. You don't mention if you're taking bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, but if you are, that's going to make it more likely that 7-keto will raise your cortisol levels too high. Anyway, I think you should back off on everything for a while and let the system settle down. To the audience, I hope that you noticed in Mary's story that she saw 3 doctors in rapid succession, and each doctor gave a medication. Essentially, all 3 doctors gave the same medication, and it doesn't sound like they paid attention to what had already been done. It is extremely important for you to always bring not only your current medications, but also recent medications that you may have stopped just a few days before, because I think that the 3rd doctor, the allergist, didn't register that she had received such a large dose of a depot form of cortisol. Sadly, this sort of mistake is not uncommon. And the only person who can protect you from it is you. Do not be afraid to question. Do not be afraid to make sure that your doctor has heard you by asking them, "You did hear that I was on drug X just last week, didn't you, doctor?" That doctor should thank you, because none of us want to mess up. Anthony in San Jose has a question about strontium. How much strontium and in what form should I take in addition to calcium and magnesium to reduce my osteoporosis? Finding sources of strontium is difficult. It can come in different forms, and there's no clear guidance on how much to take. Also, how much boron and in what form? Well, let's start with boron. Boron is generally just listed as boron in the literature, and that's what I recommend, about 3 milligrams of boron. Strontium is a little bit tougher, a nut to crack. First of all, most of the research that shows that strontium is beneficial is based on the use of a compound called strontium ranulate. And why is that, you may ask? Well, very simple. Strontium ranulate is a pharmaceutical that is patented and therefore can be sold and is sold at a fairly expensive cost. It costs about $1,000 a year, if I'm doing my exchange rate correctly, to take the 2 grams of strontium ranulate, which is what was used in the studies to show benefit. Now, the studies are impressive. First of all, there's some animal studies in mice that show that strontium ranulate actually amplifies the number of bone-building cells, the osteoblasts, by improving or increasing differentiation of stem cells into osteoblasts. This is very, very important information, since we don't have a lot of drugs that increase osteoblasts, the bone-building cells. Strontium was also shown to decrease the numbers of osteoclasts in this mouse model, and that means fewer cells to break down bones. It all sounds good. On an internet search, I found several criticisms in that the surface of the bone gets thicker, but we know that that might make the bone more brittle and potentially increase the risk of fractures. However, the data for fracture reduction was there. In studies of up to 5 years in duration, at least, strontium ranulate appeared to decrease the risk of hip fractures by as much as half. And that's persuasive to me. Unfortunately, this drug is not FDA approved, so those of us in the United States are left with taking strontium in one of its other forms. Strontium is available as a salt with citrate, and so strontium citrate is probably the most inexpensive and readily available form. Should you take 2 grams of it? Well, that's an open question, since research has not been done on that dose of strontium citrate. But for people who have established osteoporosis, I think it is something worth considering. The dose of boron, again, is 3 milligrams, and that's what the literature supports. One important caveat, however, on the strontium ranulate, and I think we have to assume this is true for the citrate form as well, although that's not established, since no wide-scale studies have been done. However, the groups that took strontium ranulate did have more blood clots, and in one study at least, which did show substantial benefit to the bones, several of the subjects had pulmonary embolisms. So probably a good idea, if you're going to take strontium, to stop taking it a couple of weeks prior to surgery, and if you're going to have any kind of prolonged immobilization, and if you have a history of blood clots in the leg or even a family history of pulmonary embolism, you might want to think twice about using this nutritional agent. Joseph in Soquel has a question about superficial venous thrombosis. Dear Dr. Don, in August 2014, I had a major superficial thrombosis, for some reason referred to as a DVT by the ER people, not by my primary care physician, which was treated with over a week of heparin injections, plus 3 months of warfarin tablets and PT-INR monitoring. One doctor thought that the clot was from an earlier injury, but another did not think so. So I follow a healthy vegetarian diet, mostly, but don't eat dairy products. I exercise, but have a mostly sedentary job. Now, I'm not sure about the dietary intake of vitamin K. Now that I'm off warfarin, I'm afraid to eat any kale, broccoli, and the like, and I've been following an ultra-low-dose vitamin K diet. I would like to drink a green smoothie with about a third of a bunch of kale in it and eat other vitamin K vegetables, but can I have them, or do I have to stay off of them and all vitamin K-containing foods for the rest of my life? What can cause a blood clot, and do I have to fear that I form them easily once I had one? Is there a healthy alternative to warfarin? Should I always wear supportive stockings? And thank you for your most educational show. Well, Joseph, the first question I would ask you is your family history. There are inherited flaws in blood clotting cascades that will create a person with a unique vulnerability to forming blood clots. If there's a family history of pulmonary embolism, deep venous thrombosis, or even superficial phlebitis like the one that you had, then even if you have a negative thrombophilia panel, you probably need to be cautious about your risk for blood clots. That doesn't mean that you need to avoid vitamin K. Vitamin K is a natural dietary constituent, and your body uses it in the formation of blood clotting factors. Warfarin poisons the formation of these blood clotting factors, and like many drugs, a small dose of poison is a very effective therapeutic agent. But it can be reversed with a large dose of vitamin K, which, clinically speaking, is rather handy, since sometimes people get too much warfarin and we can avoid a life-threatening hemorrhage by giving them a shot of vitamin K. That's a good thing. On the other hand, your body is smarter than that. And so if you eat a diet high in vitamin K-containing foods, that doesn't necessarily mean that you will be more likely to clot than the next person. The only exception to this statement would be if you had some sort of substantial abnormality. Superficial phlebitis is often caused by trivial trauma. The most common cause of superficial phlebitis is actually from getting medical care, having a blood draw, or having a catheter placed in a vein. This superficial phlebitis is unpleasant, but not super dangerous, because the superficial phlebitis cannot get to the lung, and it's that that kills you. A large blood clot clogging up a part of your lung and leading to a sudden death event is what a pulmonary embolism is. But that comes from the deep venous circulation, not the superficial circulation. While you were in the emergency room, you undoubtedly had a duplex Doppler study to show whether or not the deep veins were blocked, and it sounds from your email like they were not. So a superficial thrombophlebitis will resolve on its own, and while it does damage that blood vessel locally, leading to an increased risk of recurrent phlebitis, not a big increase, but somewhat of an increase in that area, it does not put you at risk for pulmonary embolism. There are so many benefits to be obtained from the use of kale and the other cruciferous vegetables that I would not shy away from them because you were on warfarin for a while. While you're taking warfarin, obviously, it's prudent to avoid warfarin inhibitors or warfarin reversers, but otherwise, it's really not that important. Now, you asked, should you always wear supportive stockings? And that depends on whether you're experiencing leg swelling. If you are, particularly after exercise, then support stockings are a good idea. In general, what I advise anyone who has ever had any phlebitis, whether superficial or deep, is to wear airplane hose. And I, personally speaking, have never had a phlebitis, but I still wear a fairly strong compression hose if I'm going to fly on a long airplane trip. What's long? Probably more than 4 or 5 hours. Given the issues that sometimes arise in air travel, wearing those stockings or having them in your carry-on luggage so that you could pull them out and put them on in the event that there's a substantial delay and the air marshal isn't letting you walk around the cabin, it's good to put on those socks. I also recommend using an aspirin before flying as a general rule, assuming that you know that your stomach will tolerate that. Alternatives to aspirin would be use of a substance called natokinase, which is a fermentation product of soy, or high-dose omega-3s, and I'm talking about 4,000 milligrams of omega-3 for about a week before you get on the airplane. This email from Bertha in Massachusetts, Fairhaven, Massachusetts. That sounds lovely. Subject, old age spot. Dear Dr. Don, thank you for your incredible information service to provide holistic and helpful information to the public. I am 69 years old, a very active female, and in pretty good health. Thanks to your suggestions on air, my osteoporosis is getting much better by the use of Forteo. But my question is that I've been developing skin spots over the last 5 years, and lately they are blooming all over my body. Why is this, and is there anything I can do to erase them? I did go to the dermatologist twice a year and have minor skin cancer spots burned off. She said these are just old age spots. My skin has always been very healthy otherwise. Well, Bertha, of course, dermatology over the radio is always just fun, but here's the suggestion. The spots could be brown and flat or brown and raised. And let's start with the brown spots. Brown and flat spots, of course, are being looked at carefully by your dermatologist. And there are a number of flat brown spots that develop. The most common name for these is senile lentigines. That's lentigines. And you can search on a browser, image senile lentigines, and get a whole lot of pictures and see whether or not that looks right. Sometimes these are called liver spots, and they often occur on the back of the hands. So that'll give you a hint, because I'm sure you've seen those on friends or relatives. Now, the raised brown spots may have a kind of a stuck-on cobblestone appearance, sort of like the surface of a cauliflower. Not shiny, that's important. And it almost looks like you could take a razor or maybe even your fingernail and just pry them off. And sometimes people do that and it bleeds and grows back. So that's not the strategy. These are called seborrheic keratoses, and they tend to occur most often on sun-exposed areas, but they can occur all over your body. And there does seem to be a sort of T minus zero aspect to these, in that suddenly a whole crop of them will erupt as you age. So those are both benign entities. If you have brown spots that have both a flat and a raised component, or shiny raised brown spots, particularly if they kind of look like half of a garbanzo bean, that needs to go to the dermatologist right away, because those could be nodular melanomas. If the spots are red and small and slightly raised, these may also be an aging change, but it's a breakdown in the blood vessel. These are called angiomata, A-N-G-I-O-M-A-T-A, and you can search those with the same strategy. Put image angiomata into your browser and up pop hundreds of pictures. You can look at them and see whether or not that looks like what it is. All right, so now to what can you do about them? First of all, lasers work well, as does freezing, for the raised brown spots that are benign, the seborrheic keratoses. Sometimes I'll actually cut them off with a flat, bendable razor blade and just burn the surface of the skin. You know when you were a little girl and you skinned your knee? And before, when you first fell down and skinned your knees, you would look and you'd see all those little red dots of capillary bleeding that meant you had penetrated the dermis, you'd gone through the epidermis, and you were in for a scab. Well, that's what we do. We go down to the dermis, and then we burn or otherwise cauterize all of the little red dots, the little blood vessels, and most of the time, this grows back without a seborrheic keratosis if you cauterize it just right. This can also be done by a laser. If the spots are brown and flat, then they can be treated with bleaching agents, also lasers. Lasers are very popular in dermatology offices. That's a $100,000 machine and you got to pay for it. But there are agents that do fade those, and some people actually respond really well to just lemon juice. So you can always give the natural cure a trial first and see if you get some fading on those. But like I said, make sure that the dermatologist clears you to do these treatments. There are pharmaceutical agents that will bleach them. Some of these contain compounds that have been shown to be carcinogenic in rats. I don't know if it's exactly prudent to use a potentially carcinogenic substance on your skin to fade a cosmetic issue, but I certainly know plenty of people who would consider it a fair trade if they're talking about their face or some other emotionally sensitive area. And I'll leave that to the informed consumer to make their risk-benefit analysis on that one. Now, if the lesions are red, either shaped like little spiders or squiggly lines, or raised like little tiny red bumps, these respond beautifully to laser and will generally go away and not come back. So, I hope this has been helpful and that with these descriptors, you've been able to differentiate what you need to do next. Susan in Aptos, California writes, I'm trying to recover from a rather extreme episode of enteric hemorrhagic E. coli. I was in the hospital for 9 days on IV fluids, which helped, but the fluids that were available to drink were either very salty or very sweet. And then they promoted me to solid foods. The first thing I was offered was chicken fried steak. No kidding. So I left against medical advice and came home, where I've been doing fine on organic chicken and vegetables broth, and have progressed now to yogurt. Woohoo! But when I tried overcooked white basmati mashed with broth, it resulted in more cramping and diarrhea, not bloody as far as I can tell, but sent in a sample for culture. I'm at a loss how to proceed to a more nourishing, strengthening diet, which isn't something the doctors seem interested in. My friend said you have a cleansing diet, and since I've already done the first part, maybe your reentry suggestions would help. I know it's tricky to give medical advice to someone else's patient, but if the cleansing diet is on a pamphlet or something, I'd love to see it. Well, I think what your friend was referring to actually was my elimination diet, Susan, and this isn't something I would necessarily recommend to you. First of all, after a severe bout of any kind of gastrointestinal illness, particularly, oh my God, hemorrhagic E. coli, you have to understand that the inside of your pipes is damaged. And so it's extremely important to recognize that this is where you're vulnerable to developing food sensitivity. And you want to vary your diet and eat small amounts of a wide variety of foods. Another important issue is to try to restore those membranes. And the recipe for membrane restoration is high-dose omega-3 fatty acids, 4,000 to 5,000 units of vitamin D, some glutamine, maybe a couple of, maybe 5 or 10 grams a day, and a little bit of zinc, no more than 25 to 50 milligrams. And what you're doing with these things is giving your gut the things it needs to heal. Oh, I left out something very important. probiotics. So you need, after all those antibiotics, to try and restore healthy gut flora. What I generally recommend for people to use is lots of soluble fiber. Oat bran, there's Ultimate Fiber, there's all sorts of soluble fibers, larch, fructooligosaccharides. These are things you can pick up at the health food store, because these are going to ensure that your own probiotics have what they need to restore the natural balance that you established in infancy. Take a wide variety of flora. We don't understand this yet, but next month, in fact, right now, I'm at a conference listening to the state-of-the-art analysis of the microbiome, and I'll be coming back with much more nuanced advice in June. Things like egg custard, Jell-O, if you can just get plain gelatin and use honey and a little bit of natural flavoring. These are really good early reintroduction foods for the raw gut. And I strongly recommend the use of liquid vitamins rather than solid vitamins right now, because it's much easier for your system to assimilate. Please stay away in the aftermath of one of these illnesses from large doses of dairy. A tiny little bit here and there, probably not a big deal, but your ability to make the enzymes that break down lactose is probably impaired. Try medium chain triglycerides. These are available at health food stores. Coconut oil is a rich source of medium chain triglycerides, and this both helps support the membranes and they do not require pancreatic enzymes, which may be in short supply right now, to absorb. I have sometimes taken people with severely damaged guts and just fed them on medium chain triglycerides and protein hydrolysate, in other words, pure amino acids. But some amino acids require active transport, so you have to be careful with the dosing. The bottom line is that it's a slow road back to a healthy membrane. And you certainly want to stay away from corn and genetically modified soy, the GMO soy, because it comes because there's a lot of glyphosate that comes along for the ride. These are the Roundup Ready soys, and the glyphosate will go through that damaged membrane and get into your system and mess with your hormone receptors. The GMO corn, because unfortunately, corn will aggravate membrane permeability. And alas, the GMO corn is full of a compound that was sold to the FDA as being harmless in mammals and subsequently proven very scientifically to be not harmless in mammals at all. The devil is in the dosing, so keep your levels of corn down. Your best bet is organic fruits and vegetables, possibly grinding them up and pre-digesting them a little bit, and clean organic sources of protein. And that can include eggs if you tolerate them, but start out with low doses. This email from Shaul in Israel. What is your opinion of this article? And I won't read you, of course, the address of the article, but I will tell you that the article is published in something called the HealthWise Report, a credible source for alternative medicine. And while they may want to present themselves as credible, they are definitely writing polemics here. And, you know, sometimes conspiracy theories are true and sometimes they're not. This article is a very strong negative polemic against an entity called ConsumerLab.com. ConsumerLab.com is something you can subscribe to. It costs about $30 a year, and you will be able to go into their website and see their assessments of products. I was informed about them a very long time ago, maybe 25 years ago or close to that. They've been around for a long time. And at that time, as far as anyone was aware, they were not getting money from the manufacturers of the products. They presented themselves as an independent investigator, similar to Consumer Reports or the Underwriters Laboratory, who I hope has certified all of the extension cords and electrical devices in your home. The idea here is that you want an independent entity to take a look at the product and make sure that it's safe and effective, or at least safe. And in the case of Consumer Lab, back 20 years ago, they presented themselves as checking for contaminants, things like lead, mercury, arsenic, and some of the other products that could creep into a supplement and potentially damage the individual. Now, many other, and I think better, entities have arisen subsequently. And the one thing that this study, or rather this polemic, does do is document rather effectively that Consumer Lab also gets money from the manufacturers of the products that they list as acceptable on their website. So essentially, it's a pay-to-play scenario. At a minimum, the cost of testing and more, a fairly substantial fee, is charged to any product, General, GNC, Costco, whoever wants to have their products listed on Consumer Lab has to pay for the testing. And of course, that raises the question, are they paying for the testing or are they also paying for the analysis? It is in fact true that Consumer Lab does not list any product that has not paid to be tested and therefore paid to be listed. I don't know, and I don't think anyone in the outside can know for certain whether or not that payment will allow you to be listed if you do have arsenic or mercury or lead in your product, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say it isn't. So at a minimum, what I would say about Consumer Lab at this point is that it is not an exhaustive list. It is not all of the products out there by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, many products that I use on a regular basis, because I have looked at certificates of analysis and found them to be pure and free of contaminants and containing what they say they contain via the technology of mass spectrometry, which I still think is probably a better technology than the DNA analysis that the Attorney General of the state of New York touted as being the best technology a few months ago when he presented his report on the lack of quality in herbal supplements. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. I'll be back next week to take your calls and read your emails.